From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, we'll hear about the money Oakland might be losing by hiring police officers who don't live where they work.
What we have now is we have roughly 9% of the police department living in Oakland, and we have a very confrontational relationship between the police department and the city's communities of color.
Then we'll hear how the Oakland Police Department can forge a better connection with the community it serves.
I do believe that the generation that's going to change Oakland PD, the generation who's going to live here and know what's going on here.
And we'll meet some young men from Oakland who found a way to talk about violence through the art of filmmaking.
You see these things every day and you get used to it. It's a part of your life. Crazy stuff happens out here, so, you know, this program really, we're able to talk about crazy things happening.
We're getting real with Oaktown today on Cross Currents. The smoke from the Chevron refinery fire that started late Monday has cleared, but the controversy was still hot at a community meeting last night in Richmond. Around 700 people attended the meeting, where Chevron General Manager Nigel Hearn and local government and health officials faced frustration and anger. KALW's Julie Kane was there.
Those of you who are feeling afraid, very quietly stand.
That's Joan Davis from the Richmond Community Foundation. She moderated the meeting.
Those of you who are feeling angry, please stand. Quietly, quietly. Quietly.
Almost everyone in the hall got to their feet. They sat down again to hear from Nigel Hearn, the refinery's general manager.
We take personal, and I take personal and full responsibility for the incident that occurred last night. And I'm really here to respect you and to hear what you have to say and to listen about your concerns this evening.
A long line of people formed down the middle aisle, waiting to speak on a microphone. They were talking about everything from illness and contamination from the fire to racism and economic inequality in the community.
I didn't get a phone call from the response saying that something had happened down at Chevron. I did not hear the sirens until maybe about 7 o'clock, okay? So you need to fix your system so that everybody in Richmond will get it.
Them white people ain't thinking about y'all. Because why? A lot of y'all are black. So what, let them die? They need to set up a clinic. They need to examine everybody out here. They need to find out the extent of the sickness of people in this community.
I want to make sure that everybody in here, including the people that have not been able to get here, have access to fill out the form. I don't want to see the form on the computer so that people that don't have a computer cannot fill it out. The people that don't have a house phone, that use their cell phone, cannot know where to go.
So the problem here is that when we have somebody that has apologized, when you're saying you're apologizing for something that went wrong, then there's an action that comes after that. The first question I have, what action is going to follow with the apology?
Nothing's getting done. People are shouting over each other, and they turn it into their own political form.
Charles Hawthorne lives in Richmond, about 10 miles from the refinery. He got so frustrated that he left the meeting early.
To me, this was a big waste. Waste of time. They should have more organization, more people to have control of the chaos.
An investigation into the causes of the fire is underway, headed by the California Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Chevron officials say that they will cover expenses for health problems, property damage, and municipal costs associated with the fire. We'll have more on the claims process for local residents on Monday. For Cross Currents, this is Julie Kane.
Do you live in Richmond? You can share your perspective by calling 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106 and we'll try to get your thoughts on the air. Listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan.
In kindergarten,
I had two police officers come to my kindergarten class, and as a little kid, 5 years old, I thought it was the coolest thing in the whole world.
That's Oakland Police Officer C. Del Rosario in a recruitment video posted on the OPD website. It features a diverse group of officers talking about what made them want to be part of the force. At the end, Chief Howard Jordan comes on.
Hello, my name is Chief Howard Jordan from the Oakland Police Department. I want to take this opportunity to welcome you and ask you to join the Oakland Police Department. We are one of the best departments in the country. We're a very professional organization. We are very diverse, and I want to ask you, especially if you're from Oakland.
Did you hear that? Especially if you're from Oakland. But of the more than 2,000 people who ended up applying for the 55 new positions on the force, most were from outside of the city. In fact, more than 90% of the current police force doesn't live in Oakland, something that activists say strains community police relations. We'll hear more about that and why the department struggles to recruit from within the city a bit later in the program. But there's another element to this discussion that's worth exploring first, and that's the effect it has on city resources. Oakland spends about 40% of its general fund on police. That compares with 26% spent on police in San Jose, 17% in Sacramento, and 7% in Long Beach. Oakland's police expenditures are the focus of this week's East Bay Express cover article, which says Oakland could be losing nearly $200 million a year in revenue because the money goes to officers who live elsewhere and consequently don't spend much in the city. I'm joined now by Ali Winston and Darwin Bond Graham, who reported this story. So the big criticism of a police force that doesn't live near the people it seems it serves is that there's no connection between residents and officers, or that seemed to be the gist of your article.
Yes, and it's a two-part problem. One part is that if the officers aren't from Oakland and they don't live in Oakland, then when they come in to do their job, a lot of residents feel that they're coming in as sort of a occupying force. That's one of the phrases that we've heard, and that the community police relations are strained as a result of that. The second part of the problem is economic. If none of the officers live here, that means that a lot of money in the form of salaries and benefits is flowing out to suburban communities where officers live, where they own homes, have mortgages, and do most of their shopping.
So explain that, the money flowing out. You say that the police department is in the center of Oakland's fiscal woes, consuming 40% of the city's general fund a year, and that money for civil lawsuits is also a huge cost to the city and a symptom of some of the community relation problems. Go ahead and explain that.
It's a lot of money. Policing is the single biggest thing that Oakland spends money on. That's not unusual. A lot of cities spend the largest single portion of a lot of cities' budgets is policing. In Oakland, it's 40%. That is way above and beyond what most any other city spend on policing. Other comparable cities like Fresno and Sacramento and Long Beach spend a lot less on policing. So the police department is a very expensive and costly agency within Oakland's government. It basically, a lot of money is flowing out of Oakland because of the officers who don't live here. But if you combine the fact that there is this antagonism between the Oakland Police Department and the communities that they're policing, and that a lot of this leads to incidents of racial profiling, police brutality, and other things, that essentially means extra money that Oakland has to pay out in the form of settlements. It's economically damaging to the city also.
So you say that there's an economic problem, and then there's the problem of strained community relations largely because of this, that there isn't a sense of we're in this together, but rather, I think you said, a military mentality. And somebody in your article said this causes a mentality among officers who feels if they're entering a battlefield where the job is to get in, fight the bad guys, and then get out.
At the heart of the problem really seems to be a divide between OPD and the residents of the city that has persisted since at least the 1950s. After the Second World War, the Oakland Police Department recruited largely from the South, recruited largely white men from the South to come in and police the city. And they continued that policy even through the 1960s when they would recruit folks coming back from Vietnam and demobilizing at the Oakland Army Base. The city has never really, despite the demands of community groups such as the Black Panther Party, the city to have officers be recruited from Oakland and live in the city.
But Ali,
city officials have never really fulfilled that promise. Go ahead.
You said, though, that in the 1980s that changed.
There was an in the 1980s, we found data that indicated that roughly 18% of the police department lived in Oakland. And the father of an individual who was killed, of a teenager who was killed by Oakland police officer Miguel Masso in this past May, Adam Bluford, his son Alan, was shot to death on May 6. Adam told us that when he was a young man growing up in Oakland, in East Oakland, they had officers who were from the community, treated folks with respect, and were also viewed in a more positive light. And what we have now is we have roughly 9% of the police department living in Oakland, and we have a very confrontational relationship between the police department and the city's communities of color.
And that's reporter Ali Winston. He's joined by Darwin Bond Graham, and they both wrote the cover article in the East Bay Express. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. So, Ali, explain the consent decree that Oakland is under right now, largely for issues of police brutality.
So since in 2003, the city entered an agreement with a group of – with over 100 plaintiffs who claimed that they had been assaulted, beaten, and framed by a group of four West Oakland officers who called themselves the Riders. They had their own little name for their clique. Three of those officers were acquitted in two separate criminal trials. The city had to pay out $10.5 million in settlement money. One of those officers is a fugitive from the law. He is believed to be in Mexico right now. So over the past 9 years, the police department has been required to reform its investigations, its internal affairs, probes, tracking systems for problem officers. A lot of this is very technical work, but the heart of the consent decree is ensuring that similar misconduct cannot happen again. What's happened over the past decade is we've seen numerous problems with strip searches, officer-involved shootings, retaliations against people who have blown the whistle on problems in OPD, and also a persistent culture of antagonism and almost intolerance towards parts of the city's progressive communities and even the judge itself. There was a photograph that the court monitor noted recently that had racially offensive depictions of Judge Henderson and Mayor Gene Kwan, that was left posted outside the lineup room in OPD's building for 2 days before being taken down. So for a number of reasons, for lack being unable to fulfill their requirements of the consent decree, OPD is on the verge of federal receivership, which means that the feds would – a court-appointed master would take over control of OPD from the city. The city would lose control over financial decisions, deployment decisions, hiring and firing decisions – regarding the police, and that is something that has never been done to a police department before in the country's history.
And how does that threat of federal receivership tie in with this issue of having a police force that largely lives outside of the city?
Well, we were curious. In looking at the consent decree, we've looked through it, and we've followed the attempts to enact the reforms that are demanded in it over the years. And it seems that every time OPD accomplishes something within it, that at the same time it's like a step forward, two steps back, and then they violate several policies and new problems emerge. So it seemed to us that something deeper was going on. There's a problem that's beneath the surface that's not being addressed. So we brought in different voices into this conversation that haven't really been listened to yet. We talked to community activists. We talked to community members. We talked to persons who are organizing currently against police brutality, people who are organizing in the street to improve police-community relations. And what they kept saying over and over was, look, you can reform this, you can tweak that, you can accomplish these little technical things, but so long as, for instance, the majority of the cops don't live in the city, well, that's a big underlying problem. It causes huge alienation. There's no real accountability. The officers don't feel accountable, and they get away with a lot of malfeasance and crime.
Ali Winston and Darwin Bond Graham are reporters with the East Bay Express. You can find a link to their cover article on Oakland's police force at our website, kalw.org, or you can check out eastbayexpress.com. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. As we were just discussing, most of Oakland's police force is from outside of the city. Only 9% of Oakland cops are currently city residents. The department has increased efforts to hire locally in recent years, but those local applicants are hard to come by. High-profile cases of police misconduct over the years, such as the rogue officers called the Riders, and shootings of unarmed residents have led to a general distrust of police among many people who live in Oakland. In 2010, the city laid off 90 officers due to budget cuts. Now the city is ready to start rehiring. Many current officers, residents, and community advocates say the new cops should be from Oakland, know the city, and care about its interests. The challenge now is how to entice them to apply. KLW's Kyungjin Lee looks at Oakland's efforts to increase hiring from within the city.
Hey, what's up, man?
How you doing?
I'm all right, man. Chilling. Where you headed?
41-year-old Reggie Wooden grew up in East Oakland. He never really had problems with the police, but he never had positive associations either.
Like every other black kid growing up in Oakland, you feared them because that fear of cop is just inbred in you from day one.
As he got older, though, his perspective began to change. Now, he's got a 4-year-old son, and he says,
I wanted to break that cycle of thinking with him. You know, I don't want him to grow up to be afraid of the police or not necessarily view police officers as negative people.
Wooden's got a reason to hope his son doesn't fear the police. He's currently going through a battery of assessments to determine whether he can become an Oakland officer himself. He's one of around 150 people left in the application process, vying for 55 open slots in the academy. He says he got tired of complaining about the city's bad rap.
My motivation is to do whatever I can to, you know, turn this negative view of Oakland around. And I'm not going to run for mayor or city council anytime soon. So, you know, my knowledge of the city would, you know, it'd be a great asset to the police department.
Wooden's a homeowner and a lifelong Oakland resident. There aren't many people like him. Only about 10% of police academy applicants live in the city, and that's an improvement from the past. Officer Juan Sanchez is in charge of the new hiring efforts. He's been a recruiter for 8 years and says the department's approach has changed a lot since he started.
The mentality back then was to go out of state and recruit.
But Sanchez says he never agreed with that strategy. He was born and raised in Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood and was a beat officer for his first 7 years on the force. And he says his local knowledge was a huge asset.
As soon as they hear me speak in Spanish, they automatically are comfortable. I can communicate with this person. Great. Now I can tell them what's going on. And as they find out, oh yeah, I recognize him. He, you know, he grew up here. He went to this high school here, or he worked here, or what have you. Even more of a connection. Now they even feel, even not only can they speak the language, but now they're even more comfortable, you know, saying, hey, you know what? The people over there are just, you know, they're dealing drugs or they're doing this.
Sanchez hopes the new recruits can help bridge the gap between the department and local communities. Part of that strategy is improving local outreach.
And we had a recruiting fairs where we went out to, you know, East Oakland, West Oakland. We had a job fair at McClyman's. We had a job fair on Willie Wilkins Park at off 98th Ave and B Street.
Sanchez says the department is looking for well-rounded applicants who know how to navigate Oakland's diverse communities. While the hiring process doesn't award extra points for being a resident, Sanchez says it's an important factor. The department is especially interested in people who speak Spanish, Cantonese, and Vietnamese. The first round of testing held in May attracted a majority-minority pool of candidates, similar to the current makeup of the force.
And set up a time, coordinate with her, that you guys will be presenting on the panel in Sacramento for the select committee.
Out in Oakland's San Antonio neighborhood, George Galvis is talking to a group of young men named in the Fruitvale gang injunction. It's a city ordinance that forbids them to carry guns, be seen with each other, or be out in the streets between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. The idea is to curb gang activity, but many people think it promotes profiling and police harassment. George Galvis says these young men have good reasons to distrust the police, no matter where they're from.
Gary King, Raheem Brown, I mean, the list goes on and on. You know, but there's a number of police killings which generally aren't accounted for when we look at the annual sort of homicide rate here in Oakland. And yet these officers, it's almost nearly impossible to be let go of once you become a police officer.
Galvis says the majority of alleged police abuse situations involve a small number of officers. One news report found that just 16 officers were responsible for nearly half of the total shootings between 2000 and 2010. In 2009, OPD fired Officer Hector Jimenez after he killed two unarmed suspects within 6 months. But the department was forced to rehire him just over a year later after a labor arbitrator ruled in his favor.
I believe, you know, OPD works like just like a gang.
One of the young men Galvis works with is 24-year-old Ruben Leal. He says OPD maintains an us-versus-them mentality that's not so different from what he sees among his peers.
They protect each other. You know, they got that no-snitching thing. You know, if a police officer, you know, does something wrong, his partner is not going to tell on them. They have that blue code.
Galvis says he supports efforts to hire and retain local officers. But mostly, he doesn't think Oakland needs any more cops.
Crime goes down, they say, well, that's because we have more law enforcement and we need to maintain. And when crime goes up, well, that's because we need more law enforcement. Either way, there's sort of fear tactics and politics used for us to throw more money at them.
While there are disagreements over whether the city needs more officers, everyone agrees that good policing involves more than just locking people up. Officer Juan Sanchez says he regularly approached and engaged people in the neighborhood, especially young men, as part of his patrol duties in the Fruitvale.
There's been plenty of times where, say they were playing catch, football. Hey, can I play with you? And they were kind of shocked by it. You don't know how important that is to these kids here. And I wasn't doing it to, you know, impress anybody. I did it because I knew what it was like growing up in those communities.
Alexander Williams recently started the testing process at OPD headquarters in downtown Oakland. She grew up in Gilroy, where she says officers were not only respected, they were loved. She's lived in Oakland for 7 years now, and she says she cares about the city like it's home.
There's been no other place where I felt like I fit, where I felt like the diversity in this community and the rich history has really spoke to who I am. Who I want to be.
For Williams, being an Oakland cop means more than arresting drug dealers and violent criminals. She's confident in her ability to help change the relationship between residents and police.
Oakland gets a bad rap because people don't quite understand the beauty of Oakland. And I think as a police officer of Oakland, it'll be my job to bring that to light. But my hope is if we get beat cops on the street, we show that there's positive people who care about the community, who live in the community, I think we can really change.
As she leaves the building for the day, Williams says she doesn't blame outsiders for wanting to work in Oakland, but she thinks it's important for them to learn about the community they want to work in.
I do believe that the generation that's going to change Oakland PD is a generation who's going to live here and know what's going on here.
How do you get those people who distrust the police so much, who've had such negative experiences with the cops here, to then turn around and be a part of what they've hated for so long, right?
One person at a time. I am one person.
For Cross Currents, I'm Kyungjin Lee.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. More police presence and better police community relations are good ways to prevent violence. But a group of young men in Oakland are trying a different approach. They call themselves Warriors for Peace, and they're part of a violence prevention program that equips and trains teens to make films about Oakland. The hope is that from behind a lens, they'll see their city and themselves a little differently. KLW's Nicole Jones has more.
I'm going to set up the projector.
It's a late afternoon at The Spot, a youth center in Oakland's Chinatown. 12 young men are preparing to screen videos they spent the last 3 months making. But not without first paying a visit to the table filled with takeout Chinese food.
Just some chicken and some vegetables, carrots, peas.
What kind of chicken is this?
I don't know. It's hella good, though.
So you guys want to join us? We're just going to watch y'all videos.
Paper plates filled with food, the young men plop onto the plush, mismatched couches, and program director Mike Tran introduces the first film.
This first one is called Where Are You From, Oakland?
As the room darkens, images of news reports and Oakland skyline flash across the screen.
The filmmaker, 19-year-old Jeffrey Dang, has seen this film dozens of times. Still, he leans forward and watches closely.
Those are shots fired. A drive-by shooting at an East Bay mall.
Oh, Oakland's full of crime.
Uh-huh.
High crime rate. Oh, don't go to Oakland. It's a bad area.
19-year-old Huang Dang, not related to Jeffrey, also worked on this film.
We wanted to show the violence in Oakland, but also how beautiful Oakland is.
And a giant, beautiful, amazing lake in the center of Oakland. Are you kidding me? It was like glorious. There were like babies playing. And I was just like, this is amazing. It's called Lake Merritt. I love that.
The topics of the four videos range from gang life to teen dating violence, issues close to home for many of the youth in the room. For Jeffrey Dang, the project was also a chance to experience new parts of Oakland, like the North Side. Though he spent his whole life in Oakland, it's an area Dang rarely sees.
They really had us out there with the cameras, like trying to capture like every beautiful thing we could see in Oakland, you know? From that, like we saw like so many art pieces around, like so many like random taggings, and you just start to look at different places in Oakland in a different light.
On a sunny June morning, 16-year-old Akwesi Parker is walking around his East Oakland neighborhood, pointing out some of the places he filmed for his project. He's lived here for 5 years, and he says it's mostly peaceful, but that things can change from block to block.
It's just once you start getting into High Street and then past that, that's when it starts to get a little rowdy.
Parker's film is about teen dating violence, but interviewing people on the street got him thinking about violence more generally. Just last month, a deadly shooting took place only a couple blocks away from his house. He says the gunshots are common sounds.
I'm used to them, unfortunately, because I shouldn't be, but I'm really used to them. So, I mean, you hear them, you know.
Oakland is a young city. 40% of the total population is under the age of 30, and many of those young people grew up with violence. Over the last 5 years, nearly 90% of homicide victims in Oakland were young males. One-fifth of Oakland high school students say they're involved in gangs.
Is this okay here? I'm not taking anyone's...
Yeah. It's just a little hard because it's a...
Even young people who aren't gang-affiliated can't always escape the bad things around them. Back at the spot, Jeffrey Dang says he and his friend recently saw a woman forced into a car in the parking lot of a Jack in the Box.
Like, you see these things every day and you get used to it. It's a part of your life. Crazy stuff happens out here, so, you know, this program really, like, we're able to talk about crazy things happening, you know?
At the time, you know, I was young, you know, you grew up in the hood, your role models are the gangbangers, the thugs, the people that, you know, running the streets. You know,
for his video, 21-year-old Darian Jefferson interviewed other young people about their perceptions of violence.
Most of all of you said that we need role models. Positive role models, and that's what I wanted to, or that's what we wanted to get in the film, is like a youth voice towards violence.
Warriors for Peace is intended for young men. There are no women in the group. The spot's director, Sherilyn Tran, says that was an intentional choice.
They've been socialized to be really tough, you know, in terms of gender roles and whatnot. So we thought that maybe isolating the young men in a group just by themselves so they're able to, without any, you know, fear of like women in the room, feeling like they need to show themselves in a certain way, just so they could be open and honest about it.
Tran says giving the young men a creative outlet is a key goal of the program.
When you talk about mental health, it's usually really taboo. Are you crazy? What's wrong with you? Why do you need to talk to a counselor? You know? So we wanted to do it in a strategic way that they didn't feel like, you know, there was anything crazy to share about your feelings. And to be able to do it on a video and to share it opens up the door for like other young people to see it and to feel that they're not alone in this.
Covering the walls of the spot are hints that the young men are indeed letting down their guard. Cutouts of backpacks say, "What you packin'?" a street phrase typically meaning, "What weapon are you carrying?" But in this case, the backpack contains things like siblings, religion, a fitted cap. Again, Jeffrey Dang.
When you're here, you're with like the community and everything, and it's like a safe place to be.
The youth filmmakers will be submitting their videos to San Francisco film festivals this fall. In Oakland, I'm Nicole Jones for Cross Currents.
What do you think are the best ways to prevent violence? You can let us know at our Facebook page. We're KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Youth Radio's Bianca Brooks has been thinking a lot about a particular kind of violence, gun violence, especially after the mass shooting at a Colorado movie theater last week. She sent us her reflections.
Ever since the Aurora, Colorado shooting, I keep asking myself, when did violence become so normal? It pops up everywhere in American culture. We feel excited by it when we see it on a screen. We feel proud of it when we see it in uniform, and angered by it when we see it near our children. I stood in line for 45 minutes waiting to see The Dark Knight Rises, the same night as the Colorado shooting. I sat in the theater with many other young people and basked in the violent glory. After, I went home to rave about it on Twitter. Now I'm wondering why I'm surprised that gunfire erupted in a similar setting. I live in Oakland, where violence is not only normal, it's routine. The only thing consistent about the news is gun violence. When I see the headline, "Teenage Boy Killed in Drive-By Shooting," I may be saddened and angry, but I'm seldom surprised. The faces, ages, and locations of the victims change, but the outcome is almost always the same. And it's not just Oakland, it's the country. A 4-year-old at a Bronx playground was killed the same day as the shooting in Aurora. It's been one of the most violent summers in Chicago, with constant news of shootings. And yet the common reactions are a candlelight vigil, letters to the families of the victims, and messages promoting the courage to move on. But we need more. In response to the shooting in Colorado, President Obama said, "Out of the darkness, a brighter day is going to come." But who's campaigning for that brighter day? It's time for a call to action for all Americans, lawmakers and citizens. Not only is it time for better gun control laws, but for us to ask what made us so comfortable with violence in the first place. It's easy to say guns protect our freedom, but when you have to live in fear of death at a movie theater or the grocery store or your school, exactly how free are you? Maybe we lost our way somewhere between Call of Duty and Dark Knight and the monotonous homicide stories of modern media, but one thing is for sure. If we don't hold ourselves accountable for the desensitizing of death and murder, we're only excusing it. On the 10th anniversary of Columbine, I started to really think about gun laws. And after the Tucson shooting, I started thinking even harder. As a young person, it feels unfair to see so much death. It totally changes our outlook. A lot of the young people I know don't expect to live that long. The source of that feeling? Guns. It's not drugs, and it's not car accidents. It's the fear that every second could be your last. No one should have to live with that feeling.
Bianca Brooks is a commentator for Youth Radio in Oakland. You can find them online at youthradio.org. Before we end the show today, we want to share thoughts from one of our listeners. Shelley Jackson heard Kyungjin Lee's recent report about new regulations for employers when they're considering a job applicant's criminal history, and she left us this message.
I work for a Bay Area nonprofit, and we have many volunteers who come to our nonprofit to work on their job skills, and they have either former arrests, or former drug and alcohol problems, and they're in rehab, or they're recently on parole, things like that. And we really appreciate the volunteers who come to us with those previous histories, because they are helping us serve our community, but they also have ambition, and usually it's difficult for them and challenging for them to find employment. So in the interim, they volunteer with our nonprofit, and they gain necessary job skills, they have a consistent track record, and they're able to have a glowing recommendation as a reference for when they look for other employment after their volunteer time. So I would recommend to anyone who is formerly incarcerated or has a drug or alcohol problem to explore volunteer opportunities in their neighborhood.
If you want to give us feedback on the show, just call 415-264-7106 and leave us a message on our tip line. That number again is 415-264-7106, or you can comment online at klw.org. That's also where you can find more local news and all of our stories. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Buffy Almendares, Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Lupe Hernandez, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Mu, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also, thanks to our partners at East Bay Express. You'll find them at eastbayexpress.com. That's also where you can find an article about KALW's storytelling project, Hear, Hear. And they'll be holding a Slamwich this Friday, August 10th, at the Awaken Cafe in Oakland, starting at 7 p.m. By the way, it's free. You can find all that information at KALW.org.
Awkward. Yeah. Super soaker filled with four loker plus soco, real gross, yo. I go ham and cheese on throw rolls.
The band Wallpaper has come a long way from playing Oakland house parties. Last week, the frontman Ricky Reed was performing in New York and Wisconsin. This Friday, he'll be on stage at the Outside Lands Festival in Golden Gate Park, along with scores of other entertainers. You can find more information at KALW.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
Nothing happens if you're asleep, so stay up until you wake up. Yeah.